of the question, when did the English Reformation finish? It's not yet. It's always reforming. Semper Reformanda. That's true. But as far as historians are concerned, when do you might think?
1610.
Yeah, so possibly 1610. Don't worry, we're not going to get there tonight, but a lot of people would say sort of 1662, the 1660s, with the different acts of conformity. So when basically we've got it after the Civil War, you've got a stage where the state is imposing a form of Christianity on Britain, on England, and saying, you conform to this or you're out. At that point, people that we would generally call the Puritans had to leave. They had to give up trying to change it because the king said, this is it, and it's not changing. So I suppose you could say the English Reformation, from a historian point of view, if not from an eternity point of view, is somewhere from the 1520s to round about 1660s, but we're really going to end roughly where Ken talks with, sort of the beginning of the 1600s. So I've got a difficult job. How are you going to try and cover the whole English Reformation with all these people? We're then spending hours over it. And so what you do is you cheat. And I don't know if you saw the BBC 4 programme by the historian Janina Ramirez. But anyway, she took three books as being key to the English Reformation. That is the English Bible, the Book of Common Prayer, and Fox's Book of Martyrs. And I'm going to copy her. I won't say exactly what she said, but I'm going to use those three books as a sort of a handle on the English Reformation. If we keep those three books in view, I think we can see what really happened quite clearly. Oops, now I need to switch it on. That always helps. And hopefully, does that move across? Yeah. So that is a photo, actually, of the Geneva Bible. But first of all, let's think particularly about having the Bible in English. And if you remember, that issue is all to do with authority. So one of the key issues in the Reformation was authority. Is the church in charge or is it the king? Well, the reformers, of course, said neither. Their ultimate authority was the Bible. But in thinking about authority, a big question remains for historians when you're thinking about the Reformation in England is, was it top down or bottom up? We've seen already in Germany and Switzerland that the Reformation was a mixture of politics and religion, but you don't see it any more clearly than in England. Undoubtedly, one of the major factors in England was politics. But historians are kind of divided. There's two schools of thought among church historians about the Reformation. Some say it was entirely top down. Some would say really religion had nothing to do with it. It was all about Henry VIII and about Protestant politicians, and it was all power down. Because after all, England had been wanting a sense of independency for years. We think Brexit is quite new. Really, the Reformation was kind of the first Brexit that happened. And so some would say it sort of top down. Others would say it was bottom up. That, yeah, politics played a part, but through groups like the Lollards, the grassroots were also touched by this sort of religious movement. And the short answer to that question is we don't really know. It's really hard to tell. If you want to ask some questions about how you might know, we can look at that later. We haven't got time. But the degree it impacted England is hard to tell. But Lollardy in the 14th century clearly had a part to play. So what I want to see is Henry VIII was not a unique situation. Henry VIII came after hundreds of years of England being an island, just like today, feeling quite independent from Europe, had wanted to be independent from the Holy Roman Empire and particularly from the church. John Wycliffe, he's 1329 to 1384, he was an Oxford professor, a philosophical realist. Even back then, he was asking questions about the notion of the Mass. And he was beginning to argue, and this is what Lollardy thought, was that the church should essentially be an arm of the state. So for hundreds of years before the Reformation, already you got people who are saying it shouldn't be a case of the church in charge. Really, within your country, the state is in charge, and the church is kind of an arm of the state. As I say, we're not totally sure how many Wycliffe influenced the involvement of Lollards because they were, you know, a secretive group, so by definition we don't have a lot of records of how widespread, but clearly those thoughts were growing. But nevertheless, I hope we're laying a foundation of Reformation in England. The church power is focused on the crown. Now, at the same time, you see, therefore, in England, you've got a confluence of influences. So you've got people like Henry VIII growing in power, wanting to have it his way and not be, you know, subsumed by the church. But also you've got lots of intellectuals are pushing in that direction too. And of course, it all comes to a head in 1529 when Henry VIII wants a divorce. Even before him, other kings had tried to limit the power of the church. So Henry VII had limited the right of sanctuary. I'm sure you're familiar with sanctuary. You've seen Esmeralda, you know, the Notre Dame claiming sanctuary. So sanctuary was a major sort of weapon of the church, where the church clergy were exempted from secular justice. And it was open to massive abuse. In the 15th century, the right of sanctuary extended to anyone eligible for ordination. So you didn't have to be a member of the clergy. You just had to be eligible for ordination. And to be eligible for ordination, you required two things. You had to be male, and you had to be able to mumble a few words of Latin. And that was it. So you can see how that was open to massive abuse. In fact, one quick story to illustrate it that brought this to a head at the beginning of the 16th century is the Hun Affair. Now, I think some of you are fans of the writer C.J. Sanson. If you've read C.J. Sanson, he's a novelist who writes about the Reformation. This could come from one of his books because it's a great murder mystery story. And that's the Hun Affair. So in Richard Hun, sadly, Richard Hun's son dies in 1511. And he was buried by a vicar, Thomas Dreyfeld. Now, Dreyfeld demands payment, quite cruelly you think, but he's payment for taking this funeral of the winding sheet that the little boy came in. So the little boy comes, he's buried, and the vicar says, I want his winding sheet as payment for taking this funeral. Hun refuses to pay, so he is sued by the vicar, and then he's countersued. And he accused Dreyfeld of praemunire, which you know, is an ancient, centuries-old law which limited the power of the church. Hun is then arrested on the order of the Bishop of London and is later found hanging in his cell. Now, this is where it gets like a modern sort of murder mystery. Even though this is in the 16th century, the coroner, I don't know how, but the coroner was able somehow to ascertain that he hadn't really committed suicide. So even back then, they looked into it and they claimed he committed suicide, but the coroner said no, he's clearly been strangled before he was strung up. And three men were indicted for murder. At which point, the church claims benefit of clergy, and the Bishop of London has Hun's body burned for heresy. So that's quite clever. So immediately all the evidence is gone because the church has basically covered it up. Anyway, that's just one example, but because of examples like that, there was a huge outcry in Parliament, and the King, King Henry VIII by now, resolves it without going to the Church of Rome. He sets up a legal precedent that really, in cases like that, it's the state that finally decides. So can you see, there's a pattern, or there's generally in England, there's a dissatisfaction with the church. The church is seen as abusing its powers, and the state is wanting more power. Then we come, when we're thinking of the Bible, particularly to William Tyndale, because David spoke on him a few weeks ago. I won't go into much detail, but I'm sure you know. 1526, Tyndale and Roy translate their first New Testament English translation. And at which point, Henry VIII quite liked Tyndale. He quite liked his book of obedience. But the problem was what's known as the King's Great Matter, you know, the divorce with Catherine of Aragon. Tyndale didn't support Henry on that. And that was all that mattered as far as Henry was concerned. So Tyndale had to flee to Europe for his life. He didn't publish anything, though. It's interesting, early 1530s, Tyndale didn't write anything particularly. I assume because he was hoping that Henry VIII was, you know, things were moving. He was thinking, well, I'm going to be politically sensitive. I don't want to rock the boat. So I'll just let things take their course. And he's hoping that England's going to move in a Protestant direction. But sadly, Henry Phillips acts, he was in debt, gambling debt, a young guy just left Oxford University, and he was bribed to act as a spy, befriend Tyndale and betray him, and Tyndale's executed in 1536. But, as David said, his prayer as he died was, Lord, open the King of England's eyes, and their prayer was answered, because in 1538, 2 years later, Coverdale is commissioned by Cromwell to translate the Bible, and then in 1539 we have the Great Bible, which then in later became obviously the Geneva Bible, and finally 1611 the King James Version of the Bible. So I think that's the first chapter of the English Reformation, using particularly Tyndale, the authority of the scriptures and the impact that the Bible had on England, that simply people were so excited to read the Bible, it transformed them. And Protestant definitely had a sort of a grip hold on this country because people really wanted to read the Bible for themselves. So if that's the sort of the first chapter of the English Reformation, here's a great quote from Charles Spurgeon. "The gospel is like a caged lion. It does not need to be defended. It simply needs to be let out of its cage." I think sometimes today as Christians we can be slightly apologetic for the Bible, a bit sort of, well, you know, it says some strange things and we're a bit scared. But actually, one of the key things of the Reformation, particularly in this country, was simply having the Bible in our language and letting people read it. Lots of people were so excited, they literally learned to read by reading the Bible because they wanted to read the New Testament. They were so excited. So that's the sort of the first chapter of the English Reformation, all about the Bible, which led eventually to the King James Bible, which had a huge impact on the English language. And you could say that it's not possible to understand the English language without understanding the impact of the King James Bible, which was about 85% William Tyndale. Second book is, so we now come on to Thomas Cranmer, and he wrote the Book of Common Prayer. If the English Reformation didn't produce a reformer like Luther or Zwingli or Calvin, because they were all executed as martyrs, what the English Reformation did produce was liturgy that would change the world, particularly Cranmer's Book of Common Prayer. So this is like the second chapter. Let's focus on Cranmer especially and the Book of Common Prayer. So you have the what's called the Reformation Parliament. That's 1529 to 1536. People like Thomas More, a humanist, a friend of Erasmus, Thomas Cranmer, and the then cardinal, cardinal, who's the then Archbishop, Thomas Wolsey. So from 1527 onwards, the king is seeking a divorce. And the first person up to do this is Thomas Wolsey, the Archbishop of Canterbury. He's sent on a fool's errand. He's sent to the Pope to try and annul the marriage. And seeing as the Pope is thinking, wait a minute, I had to give you, you twisted my arm to let you marry Catherine Aragon in the first place, he's not particularly happy about that. So this provides the occasion for some more anti-clerical legislation. You've got bright young men in England with intellectuals with Protestant humanist sort of sympathies, and they see this as their chance to make a move. They see, because the king is sort of moving away from the Pope, this is their chance to politically seize power. And at that time, 1520s, Thomas Cromwell begins to work as a solicitor for Cardinal Wolsey. And the first thing that Wolsey does is he starts the dissolution of the monasteries, partially because the monastic life was kind of running out of steam, but also partly because it locks the country into the Reformation. I said this before, that later on we're going to see in the 1550s, Queen Mary tried to bring the country back to Catholicism. One of the key reasons she failed was because the nobles, including the Catholic nobles, had profited so much out of the Reformation. They're not going to take these buildings and make them monasteries again if they now own them and make all sorts of money out of them. So Wolsey was really clever in doing that. 1530, Wolsey falls and Cromwell steps in and emerges as Chancellor in 1532. 1533, Parliament passes the Act in Restraint of Appeals, and that's the first act where England is described as an empire. So from this point onwards, England is described as an empire, and from then onwards, English history is usually of English kings, tries to trace them back to Constantine, showing our kind of great history as a great supposedly Christian nation. Then following that, 1534, we have the Act of Succession, Henry VIII did that to smoke out any Catholics because in that act it diverted succession from the daughter of Catherine of Aragon to the children of Anne Boleyn, and everyone had to swear an oath to that. So that's why he's sort of smoking out all the Roman Catholics, because if you were to swear an oath saying, yes, not just I assent, but I actually agree that now Anne Boleyn's children should have succession, lots of Catholics refused to do that. And of course, Thomas More was executed. And just down the road from us, the church over there, John Fisher was also executed at that point. He couldn't swear that succession should pass on to Anne Boleyn's children. Next stage was the Act of Supremacy. So Henry VIII is made king as head over all the church. And so by the time you get to 1536, the English church is in the hands of the crown. But there's not really been a theological reformation now. Really, Henry VIII wanted a Catholic church, but with me in charge. So he's not really changing theology. He just wants to be in charge of it without the Pope. In fact, it was at that time that Henry was given the title Defender of the Faith. And he was given that title because he wrote against Martin Luther, where he probably, like today, it was ghostwritten. I doubt if he really wrote it himself. But he put his name on it and he attacked Martin Luther's theology. And that's why the Pope at the time called him Defender of the Faith. Cranmer becomes Archbishop of Canterbury in 1533. And begins to bring in various changes. 1536, he drives through Convocation the Act of 10 Articles, which was the first very modest step in a Protestant direction. And I'm giving you this chronology so you can see. 1536, the first point in England that you have any legislation that is remotely Protestant. 1536 is also the date that Calvin first published his Institutes. So can you see the huge difference there? You've got England only just starting to become reformed. Calvin is already publishing his sort of book of exactly how Protestantism works. So the continent is much further ahead than England. Cromwell comes to the sticky end in the late 1540s through his foreign policies. And you probably know the Anne of Cleves fiasco. You know, we got that painting done of Anne of Cleves as a wife and it all went horribly wrong. Never trust the photo. And Henry wasn't very pleased. So that was the end of Thomas Cromwell. Another one bites the dust, I'm afraid. 1539, Henry VIII orders a new committee to draw up something to replace the Ten Articles. It's a bit more Catholic now. The Catholic lobby is back. And 1539, we got the Act of the Six Articles, which again, just to give you a flavour of how Roman Catholic it still was. So it still included transubstantiation. There was still communion in one kind. There was still clerical celibacy. And there were still private masses and oracular confession. All backed up with severe penalties. So for example, at that time, under Henry VIII, if you denied transubstantiation, not only did that carry the death penalty, but also the forfeiture of all your property as well. So if I said that, I didn't only have to be willing to die for that, but I knew that all my family would lose everything as well. 1547, King Henry VIII dies, and his young son Edward VI comes to the throne. And with Edward VI, that period of Protestantism really is associated with two things, I'm afraid. First of all, sleazy politics. So because all the powers behind the throne, he was really just a puppet king. Because there was a council behind it, most of the people of England associated Protestantism with just, yes, sleazy politics, just trying to get money out of what was going on. And the other key thing about Edward was that he didn't execute Mary. I know that sounds harsh, but the bottom line is because he didn't execute Mary, he was storing up problems for later. But all of that is setting the backdrop because this is when Cranmer is beginning to set work on his Book of Common Prayer. And this is so key to understand because we've got to realize, remember, you've got even with the printing press, most people are still not literate. So when I say that the Bible in English transformed the country, I don't mean that everybody was reading it, but I did mean that everybody could understand it. If they went to church and the preacher read the passage, they may not be able to read it, but at least they could understand it. Now, Cranmer got that, and he saw, therefore, that liturgy was crucial to get the message out. Because at that time in England, the priesthood is still Roman Catholic, pretty much. Parliament is still mostly populated by Roman Catholics. The parish priests are not very well educated. Few people can read. So the liturgy of the service is going to be the main way that you teach people. What people hear as they go through the service every Sunday is going to be probably the biggest impact on shaping their Christian life. In fact, later versions of the Book of Common Prayer included sermons for the priests to literally read, because some of them weren't very educated. So if they could read out this sermon, this was the way of getting, Cranmer was getting his Protestant theology out. I'll move on a bit more quickly. There's various versions of the Book of Common Prayer. One of them, I think in 1549, is accompanied by the first of many acts of uniformity. So as I said, this is what's going to, in time, over the next 100 years, bring the Reformation in England to an end, that increasingly the state is now enforcing a particular view of Christianity. But with this coming through, English reformers and Europeans are starting to come from Europe back or to England. Martin Luther is Martin Luther dies in 1546. That encourages the Holy Roman Emperor, the Charles V, to sort of shut down the Reformation in Europe. So all the English reformers in exile, plus a lot of the European reformers, they head to England, including people like John Hooper. We don't have time to go through all of them. I'll just give you two. Here's a little life of John Hooper, and then we'll do in England, and we'll do John Knox in Scotland. So John Hooper, born 1495, he was a Cistercian monk. But in 1536, his monastery was dissolved, as others were. And he turns up in Oxford debating the theologians. He's beginning to move towards Protestantism and becomes a steward in the house of Sir Thomas Arundel. And while he's a steward in the house of Arundel, I don't know if it was a pretty hard-working steward, but he came across lots of books in his library that he read, including books by Zwingli and Bullinger. And he read these books, and they had such a profound impact on him that he becomes reformed in his thinking, or increasingly. Very, very influenced by Zwingli. However, because he's so reformed, and because Henry VIII is imposing a kind of a Catholic view of the Reformation, at that point he flees to the continent, where he gets married, he stays with Bullinger in Zurich, and he's particularly attracted by the simplicity of worship services in Zurich. In 1549 he returns to London, he's preaching Zurich theology, and gets into all sorts of trouble with the Bishop of London. 1550, he's invited to preach to the king, this young boy, aged 11 at the time. And the young king, as young men often do, was really impressed by Hooper's kind of fire. You've got to think, he was a real extrovert, very sort of assertive personality. The king was really impressed with him. The king was not so impressed with men like Cranmer and Ridley, who were cautious and political. And their aim was to keep the Reformation, but not to put too many important people offside. So they were doing it gently. Hooper was the kind who'd head it head on, and therefore when he preached to the king, in his sermon he took a swipe at the Book of Common Prayer, because at that time the Book of Common Prayer had praying to saints and taking oaths. And for that, Hooper got an official reprimand by the Archbishop of Canterbury. We've got to see that men like Hooper and Knox were not great team players. As you look at the English Reformation, you could argue one way or the other. People like Cranmer were much more a softly approach. People like Hooper were kind of thugs. They were like, let's get the Reformation on quickly. Which is best? Only history and time can tell. But because he was a bit of a troublemaker, Cranmer sought to move Hooper to Gloucester, away from London, so he doesn't cause so much trouble. And that's significant because Hooper says, well, I'll go to become Bishop of Gloucester, but on a couple of key conditions, and these conditions become really important for the future. The first condition is he refused to be addressed as my lord. Another was he didn't wish to shave his beard. You know, whether that's really important or not, you can decide. But this is where it gets really important. He did not wish to wear episcopal dress. He didn't wish to be anointed. And he didn't wish to wear a surplice for consecration. And the point is that Cranmer and Ridley will not grant these exemptions. They say, no, you have to wear the surplice. And that's really important because eventually Hooper does give in, but these are going to become really important later on. Where what you wear, vestments and clothing, becomes really important in the English Reformation. He's imprisoned in 1551 and finally gives in, and he agrees, yes, I'll be consecrated wearing a surplice. But when Elizabeth becomes queen, that becomes a key issue, wearing the vestments. So that's Hooper as an example. John Knox, I'll just quick few stories about him. He was up in Scotland, again a Zwinglian preacher. If you think Hooper was insensitive, Knox took it to a whole new level. Passionate for the gospel, but able to offend everywhere. Just one quick story about him. He was once captured by the French. A French galley captured him, and he survived for 18 months on the galleys. He was a galley slave for 18 months. You've got to be tough. The way they were treated were really tough. And what the French used to like to do to the Scottish reformers on board was they had a little statue, an image of Mary, and they would make the Protestants kiss Mary. Well, John Knox, in his history, he talks about an unnamed Scotsman. But the way you write, he writes, you're certain he's talking about himself. Apparently an unnamed Scotsman, when he had this image thrust upon him, and I'm quoting now from the history, the man looked about him and then threw the image overboard, saying, "If Our Lady is so refined, she can swim for herself." And afterwards there was no Scotsman urged of that idolatry. Yeah, that gives a flavour of him. But I mentioned Knox because one of the key things about Knox was his view of worship. So he was really, really key. One of his sort of sayings was, any worship not prescribed in Scripture is idolatry. And we're going to think about that in a moment. He's moving towards what came to be known as the regulative principle. He's thinking in primarily Old Testament categories. A great example of publishing as well. Here's how to offend everyone and publish things badly. In 1558, he wrote his book, for what he's probably most famous for, The First Blast of the Trumpet Against the Monstrous Regiment of Women, where he's the background of that, he's declaiming Mary, who is a Catholic queen, and the point of the book is saying, you know, Catholics are terrible, they have queens, not kings, is his point. However, he wrote it when Mary was queen. It was published when Elizabeth was queen, which was such a big mistake that even Calvin wrote to his publisher saying, don't publish anything more by John Knox, please. Elizabeth was so incensed that she exiled him to Scotland, and he was not allowed to set foot in England again. And she removed from the Book of Common Prayer that we're thinking about the black rubric that Knox had input into. But yeah, so Hooper and Knox, two examples of radical views of reform which never really took hold in the Church of England. And Knox's main thing, as I say, was the regulative principle. And then the key issues in the English Reformation came to be the role of communion that we've celebrated and vestments as well. But if we're thinking about the Book of Common Prayer and the impact of liturgy, one key application for today is what's known as either the regulative or normative principle. So here's something that maybe you want to ask questions about later, here for you to think about. A dispute arose in the Reformation, and it was classically argued out by Richard Hooker. He'd be the classic example for the normatives, and people like Knox and Cartwright and Hooper for the regulatives. Now, what is it saying? Well, there's two. Let's imagine you're planning a Sunday service. What goes into it? And there's two ways of thinking about it. The regulative principle guys, what they said was, when you're planning a service, you should only put in a service that which is commanded in Scripture. You know, so psalms, hymns, spiritual songs, prayers, those kind of things. You only put in what is commanded by Scripture. The normative people looked at it completely the other way. They said, well, we're all created in an image. We've got lots of flexibility. So they would say you can put anything in the service apart from that which is prohibited by Scripture. Do you see that approaching it from the two ends? And that's an issue that's still being borne out today in our churches. We're still working through it. It's really worthwhile thinking through, because personally, you can ask questions later, my gut reaction, if you gave me those two options, everything else aside, my instinct is to go for the normative. Of course, we want freedom. Of course, we want freedom to do things practically. Let's not get stuck in a rut where you always have to do things exactly the same way. So therefore, the normative principle, in other words, freedom to do whatever apart from what's prohibited in Scripture, that's a good thing. However, when you study church history, you can see, and the Reformation is a great example, you can see what the regulative people were getting at. And that is, as the Reformation shows, if you go for anything, that what that tends to be is what your culture wants. You tend to drift off into a direction and you can justify anything. So yeah, anyway, well, if you want so many questions about that, but I think the Book of Common Prayer leads to that question. When you're planning a Sunday service, what goes into it? Is it only that what is commanded by the Bible, or is it anything apart from that is prohibited by the Bible? So questions later. Okay, so that's our second book, the Book of Common Prayer. The last book, and then we're done, is Fox's Book of Martyrs. So we're now up to 1553. King Edward the Boy is dying. And the terms of Henry VIII's will is that Mary, who is a Catholic, succeeds Edward. And at that point, desperate measures are put into place to try and get Lady Jane Grey, the king's cousin, as queen. In fact, invitation is sent to Melanchthon, remember the German reformer, successor of Luther, to have a Protestant counterpart to the Council of Trent. The only problem is Melanchthon is basically the Dennis Bergkamp of the Reformation, and that is he won't fly, he won't travel. Melanchthon is scared of water. At one point he read a horoscope, he was really into horoscopes, don't ask me why, that warned him that he would die at water, and so he won't travel, he won't get the boat to England, so he doesn't come. And the problem is that stalls everything, and Edward dies suddenly. And the council had failed to capture Princess Mary. Remember the Catholic Mary. She runs off. She escapes. And she's protected by the Catholic Howard family in Norfolk. Ridley makes a terrible mistake. He panics and immediately comes out with a public statement saying that Mary and Elizabeth are bastards. They're illegitimate. Which basically seals his fate. But note that, because that means almost certainly he's going to die later on. Lady Jane Grey is crowned queen. But soon Mary arrives in triumph in London. And that's really important. You've got to realise that when Mary, a Catholic, arrived with all her armies in London, she was welcomed to popular acclaim. The people loved her. At that point in England, generally she was seen as, first of all, the legitimate heir. But also, as I've said, Protestantism was seen as a bit kind of seedy, a bit corrupt. It's a political movement mostly. It's about money and power. In fact, it's quite possible, we don't know obviously with God's grace, but it's quite possible that Protestantism would have died out in England if it wasn't for Mary. And we're going to see why. Mary brings back all the Catholics, Duke of Norfolk, Cuthbert Tunstall, etc., Stephen Gardiner. And she executes all the key Protestants, particularly, obviously, those who just said that she was illegitimate. Latimer, Ridley, Cranmer, Hooper, Coverdale, they're all executed. She repeals all Protestant legislation. In fact, she tries to roll back time to the 1520s. But then it all starts to go wrong, because first of all, she marries, she gets engaged to Philip II, King of Spain, which is a massive mistake. The English people generally were quite popular. But Spain is a superpower on the continent, they're very wary about that. Even the Catholic houses in Parliament don't like the fact that she's married a Spaniard. Then she tries to bring back the monasteries, but as I said earlier, that was a massive mistake. The nobles don't want to give up their money. But most of all, the main reason why Mary I, ironically, enabled Protestantism to make a comeback was that she pursued the Protestants with such aggression. Probably due to the way that they had treated her mother, Catherine of Aragon. But she rehabilitated the Protestants. Under Edward, they were seen as sleazy. But as the English people watched one by one Protestants being martyred for their faith, it brought public appeal back to the Protestants. Between 1553 and 1556, well over 250 people were martyred for being Protestants. And most of them were common people. After the key ringleaders like Cranmer and Ridley and Hooper were gone, most of the rest were just common people. And you imagine that. If in your local town, someone that you know and respect is executed and they die a martyr's death, that's going to start to undermine the state's appeal, isn't it? All the leaders had to go. But Fox took those martyrs and he turned it into a story that gave the Protestants popular appeal. It's a wonderful turn of writing. Even Cranmer was sort of rehabilitated, as I think it was David said, through Fox's Book of Martyrs. So Cranmer, when he was on trial, he recanted, and then he recanted his recantation twice. So he kept changing his mind. But the way Fox records his death in the Book of Martyrs, he has Cranmer saying, "And as for the Pope, I refuse him as Christ's enemy and the Antichrist with all his false doctrine." And he holds his right hand, the hand that signed the recantation, into the fire first, saying, "That unworthy hand will burn first." So can you see that the way Fox, I'm not disputing that it happened, but the way Fox tells the story, even Cranmer's sort of vacillation is ultimately pointing to the truth of the gospel he's trying to say. It was a terrible time. Mary was so brutal that she was turning the people back towards Protestantism. For example, here's another story. This is jumping ahead a little bit, but looking backwards. This is now Elizabeth I's reign. In 1566, Matthew Parker is now Archbishop of Canterbury. And he was concerted to receive a bill from the bailiffs of the city of Oxford. So a bill comes through. And the bill says that the bailiffs of the city of Oxford are still owed £43 out of the £63 that there was their expenditure for guarding and burning Hugh Latimer, Nicholas Ridley and Thomas Cranmer back in Mary's reign. So can you see Mary's government were not just brutal, they were mean. And they executed these people, they didn't even pay for it. And the Puritan president of Magdalen College wrote to the Archbishop and he said, quote, "The case is miserable, the debt is just." So get your heads around that. What does Parker do? He's now Protestant Archbishop in Elizabeth's reign, but he thinks it's fair. So he has a whip round with all his fellow Protestant bishops, and out of their pockets, they pay for the execution of their really good friends. That's from Dermot McCullough's History of the Reformation. You begin to get a feel of just how sort of cruel Mary's reign was. And what Fox did, and that's a frontispiece of his book of Acts and Monuments, known as the Book of Martyrs, what Fox did was a stroke of genius in storytelling. If you remember, at our church in the summer, we looked at stories. This is a great example of telling stories. I'm not disputing the facts. I'm saying what he wrote was history. But it's the story he tells from that history that is key. Because Protestants like Fox had a problem at this point. Up till then, there was only one church, the Roman Catholic Church. So if you try to say that you're a new church, how can you have any connection with Jesus at all, really? You've got to come up with a story that explains how you are really the true church. And the way he did it is what's known as the trail of blood. So the wonderful thing about Fox's Book of Martyrs is that depending on which edition you've got, people add to it. So he wrote up to a particular time, but even after his death, people just added other martyrs to it. And he starts with Stephen in the Book of Acts, and then he just draws this trail of history of martyrs, the faithful remnant within the church who followed Jesus. And they were persecuted even from, you know, like Stephen was from the Jews, but he goes through other periods of church history where people within the church are persecuted. So you can see what he's doing. He's saying the Protestants are basically carrying on this trail of history so that they're the ones who really follow Jesus. In fact, following a convocation order in 1571, his book, The Acts and Monuments, known nowadays as the Book of Martyrs, was chained alongside the Great Bible in cathedrals and churches, so that all churches had to have a copy of the Great Bible, the Book of Common Prayer, and Fox's Book of Martyrs. Now, if you want a modern-day example, I'm trying to explain exactly what Fox is doing and the impact it has on the country. If you want a modern day example, did any of you watch the recent series, The Gunpowder Plot on BBC One? Yeah. Well, that basically was doing pretty much exactly the same in reverse of what Fox is doing. If you saw that film, it was pretty historically accurate, the TV series, most of it what happened. But the story is told, surprise, surprise, it's written by a Roman Catholic writer. The story is told in such a way that you can't help it. Your sympathies are drawn towards the Catholics. So the terrible way, particularly this scene where this woman is executed, the terrible way the Catholics are executed, the way that that all of them who die, if you've seen the show, all of them who die, their faith is genuine. There's nothing political. They're all seen as personal faith in Jesus. You watch it, you just can't help feel sorry for them. Now, that's true. I'm not disputing what that happened. However, as you've heard tonight, if, for example, you started the story with Mary I and put that alongside and saw that actually the same, probably worse things happened the other way, you get a different picture on the story, don't you? So that's just a modern day example of it's how you tell the story of the history has a huge impact on the conclusion that people draw. And that was the, going back to Fox's Book of Martyrs, that was the thing about the irony of Fox's Book of Martyrs was that that's the frontispiece, but the book had lots of pictures. And again, in an age where people are not literate, you learn a lot from the pictures. Now, the irony of that is, of course, that the reformers were attacking the image of the Roman Catholic Church, but the way they used it was by using pictures themselves. So, yeah, we'll let that one slide. But I don't know how clear you can see that, but if you want to look later or look it up on the internet, that is incredible. So you start from the bottom, and I think, where is it? It's my right. So down here, that is a picture of a Protestant church service. And there you've got lots of people, they've all got their Bibles open. There's a woman there with a Bible open, listening to the sermon. The word of God is real, and they're all paying lots of attention, and it's going really, really well. Here on the right is a Catholic service. This poor woman with her rosary beads is falling asleep. There is a sort of procession over there, and they're not really paying attention. And there's a huge contrast. And as you go up, it gets worse. So if you go above there, there are a whole lot of martyrs. So they're being burned for their faith. And here, they're all worshipping the Mass. And then as you go up to the next stage, up into the heavens, you've got all the martyrs now. They're not being burnt. Now they're praising the Lord. But when you go up to there, you've got a whole lot of demons. So wow, if you look at that imagery, that picture is telling you everything that the book is trying to tell you. You've got the baddies on the right and the goodies on the left. And stories like that are really, really powerful. So that's the third book. Those three books, the Bible in English transformed us. The Book of Common Prayer shaped the service in England. And the Protestantism we experience now is largely down to that. Of course, finally came in 1662 when the King, King Charles II, after the Restoration, really brought it in. And then finally, John Fox's Book of Martyrs. By telling that story, that trail of blood, he is rehabilitating the view of the Protestants. And now they're not a sleazy political movement. Now these are people of principle who really believe in Jesus. And they can trace their roots all the way back to Stephen and, of course, to Jesus. And there we go. I could say a lot more, but that is the Protestant Reformation. I'm just going to pray now, but also giving you time just to think a little bit to see if you've got any questions about the Protestant Reformation. Let's pray.